Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Thoughtful Thursday is the day that you and I have the opportunity to meet with an expert who shares expertise and really gives us an opportunity to expand our way of thinking about any particular topic. Today is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Patty Whipfler, who, along with her co-author, Tosha Score, has written a book entitled Listen: Five Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges. That is a very interesting title. Welcome, Patty Whipfler.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brewer.
You know, just to name a book Listen and then let us know that it's about managing parenting challenges, it seems like there ought to be a lot more words and it ought to be a lot more complicated title, but you're saying that listening is perhaps an important key to effective parenting.
Yes, it certainly is. It turns out that I think Dr. Haim Janot said many, many years ago, don't just do something, stand there. And I think he was kind of pointing to the fact that when we are less busy and more open to what our children are showing us and telling us, they relax and can feel closer to us. And that sense of closeness, that sense of connection between parent and child, turns out to be actually the thing that lights up the brain and, you know, kicks it into full gear. So when children feel connected to us as parents or connected to their caregivers, that's when they can learn at their best. That's when they're at their most cooperative. That's when they really can use their time in the world to keep thinking and moving forward and learning at a great rate. So this sense of connection is very, very important. And listening, I think, is the tissue of connection. It is how we receive one another, and it is how we feel received. So it's really important in human relationships, particularly between parent and child.
So it certainly flies in the face of that very old adage that children should be seen but not heard. This is the reverse of that. And you, Patty, come to your own awareness after many years of working in this area. I just want to share with the audience that in 1989, you founded the Parents Leadership Institute, and that evolved into hand-in-hand parenting. You've created booklets, videotapes, audiotapes, podcasts. It sounds like if it was able to be created, you did. And you've also co-authored Building Emotional Understanding and created Understanding Tears and Tantrums courses. So again, you have been doing this work, focusing on this issue for many years. Were you surprised as you did this work about the value of listening?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I grew up loving playing with children and having lots of opportunity. My mother was disabled for part of my childhood, and so I wound up doing lots of being with my younger brothers and my sister, and I sort of knew that children deserved respect and that warmth really helped them a lot and that playing was really fun. Those are all things that are so nurturing for children. And I was, I guess, possibly inclined to listen to children just because so many interesting things happened when I could. But it's when I was a stressed out parent myself that I sort of stumbled upon the deep usefulness of listening, both for myself so that I could, you know, clamber my way out of feeling stressed and having that be a bad influence in my parenting, and listening to my child. There was one incident that I tell in the book in the very beginning when my 2-year-old, he was almost 3 at the time, had really bad infection in both eyes. He had pink eye, and I needed to give him drops, and he was very infected, and I knew he was going to be terrified to have drops in his eyes, and I was trying to imagine how I was going to get the drops into his eyes if he was fighting me off, and all I could think of was, you know, laying him down on the bed and kneeling on his arms, you know, and forcing his eyes open, and I just did not want to do that to him. I thought, this is going to break trust between him and me to strong-arm him that way. And I had just been experimenting with being listened to and listening to other parents in order to relieve stress and help me think, help them think. So I thought, well, what if I just listened to him? And I showed him the eye drops, and I said, I have to give you these eye drops now. They're going to help your eyes get better. And he threw himself back on the bed and cried a whole lot. And 40 minutes later, after every time he would slow down, I would just say, are you ready for the eye drops? No, I need to put them in. And he'd cry some more. After 40 minutes, he looked at me and he said, Mommy, can I put the eye drops in? And I just went, what? You're 2 years old. But I figured, why not? So I said, sure, you can try. And I, you know, put a couple of drops in the dropper, and I helped him position his hand, and he squeezed the little bulb and got eye drops into one eye, and he splashed one on his nose, so I gave it to him for the other eye, and he, you know, did that eye too, and he got up and dusted himself off and ran off to play, and the eye drops were absolutely no problem after that. And I just thought, wow, look at that. I mean, I was never dreamed a two-year-old could put in their own eye drops. And that happened after I'd listened to him for a good long time. But was it worth it? Yes. I didn't have to force him. I didn't have to dominate him. I didn't have to fight with him. And he turned out not to be scared at all. He got it all taken care of in that 40-minute cry. So it's a very, very powerful tool.
And, you know, what's so interesting about that is so many times children are actually traumatized as youngsters, and parents don't particularly recognize that that could be a traumatizing moment. And had you done what your initial impulse was to do, or your thought was absolutely not your impulse, that really could have created a traumatizing moment for him. Instead, what you were able to create was a moment of connection between the two of you, as well as his own sense of his own competency and self-care. So it's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, he became powerful in that short amount of time. He became a much more powerful little boy, and there was much less to be afraid of after that. It just, you know, when you offload fear and grief that way, it doesn't come back. You know, you may have another layer to work on, but it doesn't come back. The work you've done stays, and that's something that's unusual in parenting. So many parents are giving their children timeouts or telling them what to do and how to do it. And when you do that, they're not learning. They're just trying to, you know, not be punished. And come the next day, they're doing the same darn thing again. That doesn't really make sense, and you have to tell them again and again and again. And it wears on the parent-child relationship because it feels like children don't want to listen or don't know how to learn, when actually what's happening is that two people, parent and child, aren't connected, and that listening creates that connection. And sometimes when you're listening and trying to make a connection, feelings need to pour out, and after those feelings have poured out, things are 100% better between you, and the child can think again.
I would like to share with the audience what I thought was a fairly elegant way of thinking about what you and I are talking about, and what your book, Listen, Five Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges, is about. You say, with zero fanfare and a million interactions, you build your children's character. Their sparkle, their curiosity, their vigor would wither without the heart you put into your moments with them. Such a lovely way to explain the power of those, what many parents might see as unimportant interactions.
Yeah, yeah. I think the work of parenting is so devalued, so undervalued in our society. Everybody thinks you should be able to parent like you should be able to roll off a log, and it's very complex work. It takes all that we have. It takes our love, our patience, our thinking, our studying a situation. It takes our moral fiber. You have to answer, when you're parenting children, all kinds of questions about, you know, what is the purpose of being here on Earth? You know, why do people die? What is worthwhile in life? You know, what is good between people? What are the kinds of, you know, behavior we want to avoid? You know, just there's so many things we need to think about and explain, and so many challenges every day to overcome that I think it's just very important to understand that there is no throwaway interaction between parent and child. Everything we do teaches something.
Without commenting on a particular event in the news or a particular comment by any politician, I wonder how you would guide parents to respond to children when they are exposed to any number of the potentially disruptive, disappointing, or scary experiences or comments that children may be exposed to in the media. How would you recommend, or is there a particular way that you would guide parents to approach those kinds of conversations with their children?
I think one of the first things I would say is that we grown-ups get fascinated with bad behavior, harmful behavior, hurtful behavior, and so we watch it on the news, and that is really how news is sold. And I just think that very careful supervision about how much news infiltrates the family is appropriate. So for one thing, turn off the spigot when you can, because children don't need to be exposed to all of this discouraging stuff. In a way, it's sort of repeated over and over and over again, and most of it does not directly touch our lives, although it does directly discourage grown-ups. But we don't want our children to be discouraged before they can even handle or understand the reasons for the events around them. So that's one thing. And then when they come home kind of parroting behavior that they've seen, we need to understand that as they do that, they are trying to get our help with little behavior memes, you could say, little behavior recordings that they've seen and that just don't sit right with them. So, you know, children who watch a lot of cartoons or violence on TV will try to, you know, play the superhero and take out their pretend knife and do their karate chops. And what they're trying to do is just show you that this behavior has fascinated them. And often fascination indicates that there's fear underneath the surface. And it's very helpful to children to have you playfully respond. So I've spent probably thousands of hours doing, you know, playful, trying to capture, you know, a superhero, or trying to capture a karate guy, or trying to, you know, just falling down and going, "Oh, you got me," when somebody gives me a playful karate chop, so that they can laugh. It's like when you find a way to get laughter going in play, in which children are kind of trying out the behaviors that they've seen. That releases some of the tension. It releases their fascination with that behavior over time. And it shows that you still like them, although they have this funny little fascination with X, Y, or Z behavior, you know, with Ariel, the mermaid, or, you know, I don't know, with Barbie dolls or whatever. It's like, you know, if you can go towards it and be interested, it's much more helpful to children than if you say, you know, okay, no more of that. This is too loud. I can't handle it. So when you can, you want to go towards it and see if there's a way to turn it into play.
Interesting. And, you know, as you mentioned, cartoons, even the cartoons that are considered to be okay for children, can be pretty dicey in terms of the violence.
Yes, they can. So cartoons are full of violence.
It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. We are a society that is really hung up on violence. And I don't know, I think there are actions in our past that we have not actually turned and faced and healed from. You know, tremendous violence in the history of our country that has not really been acknowledged, or I don't know, we just haven't healed from being descended from people who have done harm to others right here in the United States. And it weighs on us in certain ways.
One of the things that you say also early in Listen is the fact that parents need to be aware of the fact that they are doing their best and they need good support. And I think of all the parents and all the societal cues that invite parents to feel guilty about one thing or another, or to feel shame about one thing or another. And you very early on tell parents, wait a minute, you're doing your very best. Can you speak more to that?
Sure. I just think that each of us, especially when we have a child, what we want is the very best for our child. And unless we are, you know, unless our minds have been altered by, you know, addiction to drugs, or, you know, unless we're under tremendous, you know, social stress, we come through for our children in ways that our own parents could never come through for us. We just do, we do an improved job even without, you know, any special support. But I think the moments when we lose it with our children, the moments when we are harsh or just can't cope with the behavior that they are showing us, even in those moments, we are still doing our best. We are still trying really hard to figure it out. But if your mind is sort of halfway shut down with stress, it's really hard to access, you know, the your better judgment, and it's hard to access any shreds of patience. And so I think I really have listened to parents for tens of thousands of hours over the last 40 years of my life, and I have really never met a parent who wasn't really trying hard and who didn't love their child immensely, you know, no matter how hobbled they might be by the circumstances that they're in. And so my assumption is, if you're having a difficult time, support is the appropriate response, you know, not blame or shame, and that we do have feelings about the mistakes we make and the awful moments we have with our children. And that, I think the one thing to do with those regrets is just to cry about them so that they don't sit on our shoulders forever, just to cry and cry and cry about the bind we have found ourselves in. And it's a bind every time. Either you don't know enough, or you don't have enough support, or you are just crazed with stress for legitimate reasons. No one has come and helped. And we have a responsibility to change our behavior, the behavior that we do when we go nuts. That it's our responsibility to figure out how to change it, but I don't think that there's any parent that doesn't have moments like this. We all share the fact that we go nuts around our children sometimes, and so it's so helpful. One of the things we recommend to parents is that they start listening partnerships, that they listen to one another in order to offload that stress, in order to think more clearly, in order to feel better about themselves and about their children. You just get rid of the negative feelings so that some positive feelings can flow back in. And what we find is that having a chance to release the regret that you have really helps parents change their understanding of their own goodness. It helps you remember that you are good, that you did the best you could, that you got caught in a terrible bind. And I think that's good for all of us. The less time spent feeling bad about ourselves, then the more time spent playing and connecting with our children.
The things that you are talking about, listening to your children, listening to each other, on the face of it, they sound so simple. And yet they, again, are so complex and so powerful. Patty, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to hear more about listening partners, listening partnerships, and how you would recommend folks really engage in that. Folks, again, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I am speaking with Patty Wipfler, who is the co-author. And Patty, I fear I've done your co-author's name an injustice. What is her name?
Oh, yes. I would love to talk about her just a bit. Her name is Tasha Shore.
Okay.
And she is a mother of three boys. She's really good at thinking about connecting well with boys through all kinds of boy behavior, helping parents like their boys.
Well, let's pick that up as well when we come back from this break. Folks, okay. Stay where you are. Before the break, you mentioned your co-author. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, she's a mother of three boys. She enjoys her boys tremendously. She also puts a lot of verve into her writing, and so she's someone who has done blogs and has written parent articles on a regular basis for newspapers. And she came to one of my support groups about 10 years ago, and she was under a lot of stress at the time. One of her children was often sick, and there was just a tremendous amount of stress on their family, and she found the support group very, very helpful and really stayed with it, and really she's one of our key trainers at Hand in Hand Parenting now. And I really I like to work collaboratively, and I'm trying to write the book, you know, by myself was just not working. So I just asked her to do it with me, and we took off and did it.
And your co-author's name again is?
Tasha Shore.
And that the last name is spelled S-C-H-O-R-E. And your last name, Wipfler, just for the audience's information, the last name is W-I-P-F-L-E-R. Patty, listening partners, you talked about that a moment ago. What exactly is a listening partner?
A listening partnership is an agreement, a simple agreement between two people, between any two people, really, that they will do just a few things. One is respect the other person's intelligence while they're listening, offer the other person warmth while they're listening, even if they don't know them very well. Just assume that they are a good, intelligent, and you know, respect-worthy human being, and that they will listen and not interrupt, and that they will not judge or comment or give any advice, and finally, that they will keep whatever the person says confidential. They won't spread the person's story all over the neighborhood or even tell their partner what they heard in the listening partnership today. It's like you hear it, you think about it, you remember it, you understand it, but you do not spread it anywhere. And this frees parents to go ahead and say what's really on their minds, you know, the kinds of thoughts that parents all have almost every day. That gosh darn kid, what is he doing now? Why do we have to go through this again? You know, I just want to shake him. I want to shake him. You know, and just basically the thoughts and the reactions that consume us when our children push our buttons. And it's those thoughts and reactions that erode our patience and that make it hard for us to parent the way we would like to. You know, we get caught up in our reactions, and then off we go. We're yelling, or we're hitting, or we're doing time out again, even though we've noticed that it really doesn't work. So it's a way to offload stress so that we can parent more aligned with our intentions and our decisions. And a listening partner is there to offer warmth and respect while we do this, so that there's someone connecting with us while we are trying to connect with our own best selves and get the reactions that we have, the emotional content that we that our children can trigger so easily from day to day, get that out of our way and taken care of. So when a listening partnership is going well, people are not talking a whole lot. They are just having a good laugh. They are contacting the feelings that come up when they get frustrated beyond the beyond, and noticing how frustrated they get and just being able to cry about not wanting to be, to have their feelings, you know, pulled to that state by their children, not knowing what to do, but just being beside themselves with grief or fear or frustration. So you would see crying, you would see laughing, you would see if someone's working on something that was really scary, they might, their body might get really hot, they might tremble, they might perspire. It's like those are all signs that fear is releasing. And so when a listening partnership is going well, you are talking, you are noticing what you think, you're kind of following your train of thought, and the other person is right there with you going, wow, yeah, tell me more. And that's really almost all they're saying. And when you're done, when the time is up, so say you have an hour, your half hour is up, they help you pull your mind away from the things that are, you know, emotionally engrossing, and you have share a little chuckle maybe, and then you listen to them. So they get listened to, and they can look at their experience and try to figure out how they want to be and what they want to do next. And it turns out that this very simple exchange of listening time can make a huge difference in a parent's life. I think the, you know, the hard things that we go through as parents are indeed hard. We've never done this job before, and here we are trying to figure out how to get a child to sleep at night who is scared to death to sleep by themselves, or, you know, there's so many problems we have to solve that we've never faced before. And but when there is someone who will listen to you about the challenges in your life, then you're not going through it yourself, all by yourself. You're not going through it alone. Someone is appreciating how hard you're trying, and that makes a huge difference. And having someone listen to you while you try to sort your thoughts out means that there's twice the attention on your thoughts, and so you really, your thinking process goes better when someone is listening than it does when you're mulling things over by yourself, because we all get into little ruts, you know, when we try to solve a problem by ourselves. You know, the same thought occurs again and again, and it's not a useful thought. So it's a great boon to thinking, to creativity, to figuring out what's the next experiment so you can learn what works with your child. And it's a way that you can get rid of stress right then and there so that you go back more relaxed and more present into your family.
I would think that one of the difficulties is really the non-judgmental piece. For both parties, particularly if they're hearing something that's completely different from what they would do or the way that they think.
Mm-hmm. That can be hard. And especially at first, you know, getting rid of the conversational habits we have, the habit of judgment, the habit of interrupting, the habit of, oh, you know, my kid did that too, here's my story. Those habits, it is very uncomfortable at first when you're not falling into those little behavioral ruts that we all have around normal conversation. So it doesn't, you know, it's kind of like putting on a new shoe. It's like it's a little tight at first, and you're not sure if it's really going to fit. But, you know, you go home after someone has listened to you, and you notice that you are a better parent for the next 3 days until things build up again, and you go, yeah, I think I'll try that again. And the next time you go, it doesn't feel quite so strange. And you notice that, although it's really weird that they don't ask you questions or butt in, that you are sort of exploring more of your own experience and kind of having ideas you would have never otherwise had. And you just find that through your own experience, through being listened to, what is helpful. So we all learn sort of as much from listening to the other person as we do from being listened to ourselves. And slowly but surely, these guidelines begin to make sense. And you get to watch the other person come back and say, you know, after you listened to me, I had this interesting idea and things went really differently and it's been such a much better week. And so you get feedback that your listening helped, although you didn't judge and you didn't give advice. And, you know, that's how we learn to do this, is really noticing from other people that their lives are going better.
I would think, too, for those parents who might say, I've got 3 children, I've got 5 children, I've got whatever, I've got more than one, I don't need to have a listening partnership, I already know how to be a parent, but I'm thinking that even if you've had 12 children, each child is different, so you don't know how to necessarily, you don't have all the answers to parenting that one child in front of you, although you may have what you see as the answers for the 11 children before.
Yep, yep. And in parenting, you kind of never know what's coming around the corner. I remember there was a couple that were in a parent listening group that I was doing in a corporation nearby here. Husband and wife, they had 2 different jobs, and one day their little 18-month-old son had a febrile seizure, the kind of seizure you get when your temperature goes up to 105, and he didn't come out of it for more than an hour. He was just rigid. His eyes were kind of stuck open. He didn't respond to them at all, and they were so frightened. They'd never seen anything like it, and they rushed him to the emergency room, and the doctors and nurses went, you know, we're going to take him, you sit over there and wait, and we'll tell you when he's okay. And they just were like, no, we want to stay with him. He needs a sense of connection. He's at his most vulnerable right now. We want to stay with him. And the doctors and nurses were really insistent that they leave, and they were both very upset. And they knew that, you know, their upset was part of the reason the doctors and nurses wanted them to leave. So because they'd learned how to listen, the wife went, I'm going to the bathroom. I'll be back in 5 minutes. I'm going to go have a cry. And she went in, and she sobbed in the bathroom really, really hard while her husband kind of stood watch over their son. And then after she had, you know, kind of taken the top off of how scared and how upset and how really alarmed she felt, she came back, and she said, you go in the bathroom. It'll really help. And he went in the bathroom, and he sobbed and cried and shook with fear, in the middle of this very, you know, challenging situation for them. And he came back, and that got them both down to a state where the doctors and nurses allowed them to stay with their son for all but 5 minutes of the whole time that he was in the emergency room. And they were so proud of themselves. They felt so pleased that they'd been able to support each other, that they'd been able to offload enough stress to actually be thinking about their son in that situation and not consumed with their own feelings. So even if you've got 5 children but things are going just fine, that's not a state you can depend on from day to day. And this tool is really good in emergency situations.
What a powerful example of allowing yourself to feel your feelings, and particularly with support from someone you care about and trust.
Yeah.
You say that parenting is indeed the cradle of leadership. What do you mean by that?
I think that all of the skills that are important in bringing people together and helping them align their thinking and act in concert to make things better, all of those skills are skills that we can develop as parents, especially if you are using listening tools. So one of those skills is indeed just listening itself. If you're a good leader, you are listening in ways and at regular times to everyone in your organization, or you are finding ways that everyone gets listened to, and then you hear what those other listeners are finding. So listening, connecting with people, is sort of at the heart of organizational success. I think the second one is being able to think about what is the key issue. And if you are too upset about the situation, if you are too scared, if you are feeling too confined, you know, too constricted by what society says or by the way you've been raised, you can't think creatively. And when you have listening support, you can offload the places where you want to try to do something, but you've been taught that women don't do this or that men don't do this, and you're feeling a little weird about it. You can offload those uncomfortable feelings so that you have the freedom to experiment and see what you think. You know, do you really want to do this? Is it something that's fun? Is it something interesting? So being able to extend your ability to think about the key issue and help define the key issue. Listening, one thing parents do is parents are used to having children tell them that it's all their fault. You know, you're the worst mommy in the world. You never let me have enough ice cream. He always gets more. You know, if children are unhappy, they almost always aim that unhappiness at us. And every good leader needs to be able to know how to handle that kind of feedback, how to handle people's tendency to target the safest and the most visible person around them. And so learning how not to take that personally is a very important leadership trait, and we develop that as parents. So those are a few sample skills that leaders have, must develop in order to lead well, that we have plenty of opportunity to develop in parenting.
Interesting. You mentioned social impact. What are some of the social forces that you would say complicate parenting? We know that, you know, exposure to media and news can have, you know, its own set of complications. Is there anything else?
Oh, there's lots. I think the biggest one that comes to mind is racism. Racism is a terrible burden on the backs of parents of children of color, because the threat in the outside world, excuse me, that your child would be treated badly just because of how they look or their skin color is very real. Every parent who has been targeted that way has grown up with it, has suffered from it, has had their opportunities limited by it, and they feel very protective of their children. And the tradition often is, you know, I will come down hard on my children so that no one in the outside of our family will come down hard on my children. So I will be extra strict about them looking okay when they go outside, and I'll be extra strict about their behavior when we're going outside because I don't want them to be targeted by racism. But we wind up, you know, being agents of the very thing that we don't want our children to run into. It's like we're being hard on them, and we're being extra tight and extra worried and extra scared. And so it's something that happens in many ways. So I think racism is one. All kinds of, I think sexism is another. You know, it's just watching our girls kind of lose their enthusiasm for running around and jumping and exploring the world physically and putting all their energy into little tiny doll clothes. That can be hard to watch and hard to figure out what to do about. So there's lots of dynamics in the larger society that get played out within our families that are not so easy to figure out.
The two isms that you've just identified, racism and sexism, is certainly huge and certainly complicated. When we come back from the break, I'd just like to explore a little bit more how you would guide parents of all colors and of all genders to sort of take a look at those experiences with their children. Folks, again, I am having a conversation with Patty Whipler, who is the co-author of Listen, 5 Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges. We'll be right back. Patty, the impact of society at its worst in terms of the expressions of racism or sexism or homophobia, or we could probably spend an hour running down the list of ways in which, as human beings, we have a way of tending to want to isolate the other, so for all kinds of reasons. Is there an age at which it makes sense to begin to have these conversations with your child? Or do you wait until your child comes home with an example of these kinds of situations? How do you negotiate that?
I think the first thing I'll say is that the best book on this topic that I know is a book called I'm Chocolate, You're Vanilla, Handling Issues, I can't remember the exact subtitle, but it's Handling Issues of Race in a Race-Conscious Society. And it's by a woman named Marguerite Wright, Dr. Marguerite Wright. She lives here in the Bay Area. It is a wonderful book, and it's a real study of how children's thinking around skin color and racial identity and racism develops through the years. And it's just a very interesting book and very helpful. But I think you tackle this whenever it shows up. And sometimes fear of how people are different shows up very early in children. And in our book, we have a section on, we talk to people about using the five listening tools that we describe to undo children's fears, to actually relieve children of fear at the root so that they are, you know, feeling safer in the world and thinking freely, and basically just so that fears go away.
Can you give us in a bit of a nutshell what the five simple tools are? I know you talk about stay listening and play listening. What else is there?
Okay, I'll name them all first, and then I'll give you a little one-sentence scoop on each one.
So
listening partnerships we've discussed, that's where any two adults who want to can exchange listening time, the favor of listening. And over time, it gets safer and more effective at offloading stress for each of them. The next one is special. Well, the parent-child tools are special time, play listening, setting limits, very important, and stay listening. Special time is pouring your 100% attention into your child for a specific period of time and naming it special time or mommy and me time so your child knows they're getting 100% of your attention. You approve and the child decides what's going to happen during that time. So it's a time for your child to choose, your child to be in charge of the relationship, and it really helps children feel felt, understood, close to their parents. It's a great tool for building cooperation and understanding. Play listening is getting laughter going in play without ever tickling a child. It's, you basically get laughter going by taking the less powerful role. So if your child is, kind of bouncing on your belly as you're, lying down, you go, oh my gosh, oh my heavens, and they'll laugh and laugh and laugh and keep bouncing away. And anytime you get laughter going, and you promote it, children are offloading stress. They're getting less scared of things and much more confident and much more full of themselves. It's really a lovely, very connective tool. Setting limits is a tool that we wish parents would use early and often. Setting limits is very important for helping children, keeping children from, interfering with their relationships with other people, keeping them from hurting themselves or others, keeping them from driving you nuts. So when you, first see that a child is kind of going off track and doing something that, you've said shouldn't be done, you just go over and you bring the limit. You don't say from 5 feet away, don't stick your finger in the light socket. You just go over, put your hand over the light socket, look them in the eye and go, uh-uh.
That's it, and just then uh-uh.
You follow that with stay listening. So basically when children, you stop a child from doing something that is really off track, weird, not helpful, then what happens is that you allow them to feel the feeling underneath everything that is driving them kind of out of their mind. It's driving them to do something that they know better about. And as they cry and cry or have a tantrum, you stay, you offer eye contact. Sometimes you touch them or hold them, sometimes you don't. That's really, you know, you figure that out with your child, what works the best. But you listen while all those feelings pour out, just like I did when my son couldn't stand the idea of getting drops in his eyes. I just kept saying, these are the drops, we have to put them in. So I'm setting a limit there. This is what has to happen next. And he's working on his feelings while I stay listen. So connection goes in. I'm offering connection. And all the bad feelings that keep a child from feeling safe and connected are pouring out. So you have this nice double action. You pour in the connection. Your child pours out all of the emotional static that's in the way of them understanding that they are safe, that you are there, that you care, and that whatever it is they wanted, they are fine without for the moment because they have you. So stay listening puts you in as the substitute for the third cookie or getting away from having eye drops or, you know, having the toy they just grabbed from their sister. You know, you hang on to the toy, you listen to their feelings, you keep saying, I think you need to give it back to her now. And you wait until they actually can decide to give it back, so you're not grabbing from them and modeling grabbing while you do it. So these are very powerful tools, and when you use them over time, you don't have to use them all the time, you just need to use them when you can think to do it, children's behavior clears very nicely, and they become more flexible, more generous, more attentive to others, less afraid. Very good things happen to children when they have these ways to connect and outlets for the bad feelings that happen when they don't feel connected.
I noticed that, you know, some of these activities, they take time. Like with your son, it took 40 minutes.
Do.
So for the stressed out single parent who's saying, I don't have the time for that, what do you say?
I say that basically what most parents do is their time is frittered between, you know, trying to control a child's behavior here and trying to control a child's behavior there and trying to get them to come to dinner when they don't want to. And we are kind of running around trying to make our children do the right thing with a minute here and a minute there all day long. It's wearing, it's not rewarding, and we don't feel close to them while we're doing it. So when you begin to spend a little more time actually using a listening tool, it does take time, but the rewards you get back sort of clear away all of these little moments that just don't work well. Pretty soon you don't have so many of those, and you have more energy, and your child is more pleased with you. So it's kind of like putting money in the piggy bank. It's like you put in a few pennies every day in the form of special time and play listening. And pretty soon, you and your child have a rewarding relationship that you share. So it's not, you know, there was one mom who had four boys, single mom. Her third boy was just, you know, climbing the walls all the time. We talked to her about special time. At the beginning of a weekend, she gave her son special time just to try it out because he was always the squeaky wheel. He wanted to light matches. He wanted to lay matches out on their lawn in this great intricate design and light them and have them burn one match to the next. And she paid attention while he did this for about 20 minutes on Saturday morning. She said the whole weekend he was an angel. Now that was 20 minutes investment, and she got back a very pleasant weekend out of that, just that one 20-minute time. So it's, you know, it's just a different way of using your time, and I think our experience is it works better.
That's interesting.
But you have to try it and see.
That's an unnerving wish, but it's interesting that just that 20 minutes made such a huge difference.
Uh-huh, and it's not like she's going to let him light matches anytime he wants. That's a special time activity. She has to be paying 100% attention, and the matches are under lock and key the rest of the time, so you're not saying, oh, I allow this all the time. You're saying, in this special time when I'm here with you, you can do anything that's safe, because it was safe while she was watching and supervising and helping his dreams come true.
The idea that you have to actually name the time, you make a point of that. Why is that so important?
Because when you slide in and out of paying warm, loving attention to your child actually never knows whether you're going to be there for the next 2 minutes or not. We, you know, we run and answer the phone, we have to go fix the pot that's boiling over, the dog barks and we go see what happened to him. You know, to our children, we look like we have ADHD. We are getting interrupted or multitasking many times a day. So special time, you name it. You say, we're having special time. You clear other distractions out of the way. You refuse to answer the phone. You just are there for them. And they get a sense of being protected and having our 100% attention. And it attunes them to what it feels like to really be connected. So, you know, 6 months down the line after special time, you know, twice or three times a week for 5 or 10 minutes, they know what it feels like to feel connected, and they're starting to get, you know, frazzled because their little brother is stepping on their toy and interfering with this and that. They can come to you and say, Daddy, I need special time. Instead of, you know, socking their brother in the mouth for the behavior that's driving them nuts, they notice that they don't feel good. They notice they're out of connection. They come and they ask for what they need. They don't have to hurt somebody to signal that, you know, things are not right with them. So it becomes a way that children can be in charge of, you know, keeping that connection going. They can tell you when it's not there, and you may trust you to respond.
So they're also learning how to ask for what they want, and they're having the experience of having that ask responded to.
Yep. There's a lot of trust that's built in, you know, over many little 5 minute special times. There's a big bank of trust that's built between parent and child of, if I ask, you can, you know, put other things aside and prioritize me. I can absorb what I need from you, that very valuable sense of connection, and get my mind going again so that I'm, you know, back in sync with other people and I don't feel squirrely and ready to pop off and hit somebody.
I notice also as you talk about laughter that you make the specific point that it has to happen without tickling. Why is that?
Yep. Well, when we tickle children, we're not allowing them to be in charge of what happens. We are intruding. We are deciding, you know, where we tickle and how long we tickle. And because many of us were tickled thoughtlessly as children, we often don't know when to stop. And children have a hard time signaling for you to stop because they don't want to lose your affection. They don't want to lose the connection, but they also don't like being out of control of their body. So in my mind, tickling sort of teaches a child to tolerate something that's happening to their body that they are not in charge of. And I don't think we really want to teach our child that.
Not at all.
Yeah, I think what we want to do is earn laughter the creative way, you know, by just noticing what lets your child laugh and then doing that again by being goofy, by creating affection games. Oh, I've got 10 hugs for you. You just got home from school. Come here, you. And then spending 5 or 10 minutes running around the house trying to catch one half of a hug. And your child is jumping on the beds and hiding here and hiding there. And you are falling and stumbling. And, oh, I almost got you, but no, I didn't. Oh, dear, what am I going to do next? You know, so you're taking the less powerful role, and this delights children deeply to not be the one who can't quite do it. You know, if we take that role, they just love it. And it, in a way, playing that way kind of, it helps to even out the sting of grown-ups always being in charge and grown-ups always knowing what needs to be done and grown-ups always being more competent. You know, we get to play the incompetent one. They get to laugh and laugh and laugh and feel very much closer to us because we're willing to do that, to let them have the powerful role.
Interesting. One of the ongoing concerns between parents is when a child is crying, do you let the child cry? Do you ignore the crying? Do you try to stop the crying? What's your thought about children and crying?
What we've seen over time is that if there's a listener and if there's no immediate danger, crying is a very powerful healing process. It's only healing when someone is there making sure the child is safe, making sure the child feels cared about. Well, actually, you can't make sure a child feels cared about. Offering caring to a child until they can feel it is actually the better description. When children are crying, they are offloading a sense of hurt and a sense of separation oftentimes. Sometimes they're offloading fear as well. And while they're doing this, they feel it very, very intensely. And it helps if we don't try to talk them out of it, if we just say things like, I'm right here. I'll stay with you. You're safe. Whatever scared you is over. It's over now. I've got you. I want your life to go well. And when you say just the right thing, the feeling of hurt comes rolling out. So you say, I want your life to go well, sweetie. And your child goes, you do not. You always give him more ice cream than you give me. Every single time, he always gets the best. And they cry and they cry and they cry. And that's the hurt that is healing. They tell you the hurt. You don't argue back. You listen so they can feel it fully. And when they have felt it fully and cried about it thoroughly, that hurt is so much less than it was. You know, it may not all be gone because some hurts go pretty deep, but a child will feel so much closer to you and deeply relieved, and their behavior will change in obvious ways after a good cry like that if they get to cry all the way to the end. It's a little bit like sleep. There's an internal mental process going on in the brain. It is a cleansing process and a very healthy process. We don't understand it, same way we don't really understand sleep very well. It goes on inside. You can't exactly see what's going on, but there's an outward sign. The sign is crying and trembling and sweating. And if you are there to protect the child and care, they will heal from whatever the feeling is that they are crying about. And they'll tell it to you in great detail with great drama, because that lets the power out.
Patty, please give us a website where our listeners can go to learn more about what you're doing.
Sure. We're at handinhandparenting.org, and you can get the book by going to listenthebook, all one word, .com. And that's, you know, it's readily available, and there are something like 130 stories from parents on 5 continents, parents of 1 child up to parents of 8 children.
Oh my.
Are telling their stories about how this works in their family, parents who are poor, parents who are not, parents who are targeted by racism, parents who are not. It's really a wide variety of parents telling how these tools have worked for them to make life much more connected and much more fun between them and their children.
Patty Whipler, co-author of Listen, 5 Simple Tools to Meet Your Everyday Parenting Challenges. Patty, thank you so much for your time today.
That's a pleasure to be with you, Pamela. Thanks for your great questions.
Alrighty. You take care. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical or mental health or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can always send an email to Pamela at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And of course, the website is mindtalk.org. And you can go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. Once again, I thank you all for joining us. And remember, if it's unacceptable, that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.